Well, welcome back to CMDA Matters, and I'm your host, Dr. Mike Chupp, the CEO of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. I trust you had a wonderful holiday season as we've entered a new year and a new decade. I don't know about you, but I tried something I hadn't done for quite a while. Right after Christmas, my oldest daughter, who's very adventurous, convinced me to go down a ski slope. That was a blast, being reintroduced to snow skiing, and I did great until the last 30 seconds when I found out that skis and mud don't go together, and I did a face plant, and it led to some really great laughs from my daughter and the crowd that was around at the bottom of the hill. I think we have a great program for you today. My guest, Dr. Andre Van Maal from California, will be talking about the transgender tsunami and an appropriate response from Christians in healthcare. But before I get to that, related to the same topic, I wanted to let you know that CMDA has been very active for many years in public policy. And in 2016, for the first time, we joined several states in actually suing the federal government over a transgender mandate, as we called it, that came out of Health and Human Services. It was a national injunction that we participated in to stop a rule created by the previous administration that it would have eliminated your ability to exercise conscience and medical judgment regarding transgender procedures and prescriptions, even for children. A federal court in North Texas agreed with us that this so-called transgender mandate violated federal law. So now you and other doctors nationwide are protected from what we feel is an unreasonable and unethical requirement. If you want to learn more about that case, you can go to transgendermandate.org and learn more about that result and what it does for you as a Christian in healthcare. We have a more recent court case involving Health and Human Services. This time, we joined in as an intervener for HHS that came up with a very important conscience rule last year, made to enforce several dozen federal conscience protection laws in healthcare. And by intervening, we joined the federal government in defending that conscience rule. On the other side, several states and Planned Parenthood sued the federal government because they saw this being a risk to them. Having healthcare professionals who refused to do abortion was going to create problems for them. In the first round in New York, we lost that case. The federal judge vacated the HHS rule that we were supporting, but we have appealed, and so has the government as of January 6th. So we appreciate your support and your prayers. If you want to learn more, go to freedom2care.org, freedom2care.org, to learn more about that particular case. Well, let's get to my interview today on CMDA Matters. My guest today is Dr. Andre Van Maal. He's a board-certified family physician in private practice in Redding, California. He's actually co-chair of the American College of Pediatricians Committee on Adolescent Sexuality. He's a frequent blogger on the CMDA Point blog. He works with Alliance Defending Freedom in Defense of Culture and Life and First Amendment issues. He also advises the Global Medical Research Institute. Andre and his wife love children. You're going to hear that in the interview. And they have been taking care of foster kids for a long time in California. They have two sons and two daughters who were formerly their foster kids that God led them to adopt. Let's get straight to this very informative interview, my discussion with Dr. Andre Van Maal about the transgender tsunami. Well, I want to welcome to the program today Dr. Andre Van Maal. And Dr. Van Maal is a family physician in California and has been very involved in a great deal of legislation and trying to bring some common sense to California. Tell us a little bit about that activity that took up a lot of your time. I believe it was earlier this year, was it not?
Actually, it started early in 2018 with the introduction of three bills, at least one of which raised the national prominence. But one of them dealt with basically, you know, transgender affirmation for foster kids, as well as some other bills on trying to achieve wider bans against therapy for people with unwanted same-sex attraction or other unwanted sexual attractions. And so I was involved in both, but in terms of testimony and organizing things that way, my primary effort was opposing that transgender foster care bill, as I will call it, working with individuals, like-minded doctors and others, trying to expose our legislature to where science really was on the subject, as opposed to ideology, and that this was something troubled kids, especially foster children, needed to be protected from, as opposed to, you know, thrown into. My wife and I, in addition to our own two sons, have had 9 foster kids.
Wow.
From whence we got to adopt our 2 daughters. That's where the girls in the family came from. And my wife is trained as an obstetrics and pediatrics nurse, which she did lay that career aside when we started having kids. But obviously, her testimony had a special weight as not just a medical professional, but a concerned mother and foster mother.
Well, of course, our subject today is about gender identity issues. But before we jump into that, so what was the outcome of all of the many, many, many hours of efforts that you put into educating your legislators there in California? Victory, partial victory, defeat?
On this particular bill, we lost. On the larger one, AB 2934, that perhaps everybody's heard for, the larger team ended up winning by virtue of relationship with the sponsoring legislator, who, despite having the votes to easily pass that bill anytime he wanted, ended up actually pulling it from the floor. Stuff that you won't hear about in papers, that's actually apparently how God gets a lot of stuff done. You've heard the saying, the kingdom of God is the kingdom of right relationships, and people trying brave, risky relationships on this, it actually worked out. On the transgender issues, as well as the other of opposing therapy bans, the larger goal we were trying for, and that I was certainly pushing for with allies, was number one, to wake up the church in California, which had kind of gone to sleep politically with the 2 losses on the Proposition 8, you know, trying to establish marriage as what it's always been for all people, the union of a man and woman. And those won at the ballot boxes, but of course they were overturned by the courts. And a lot of the churches just figured, well, you know, we get to be light and salt for Christ here and make disciples, but obviously politics is a lost cause. Let's not do it. So our goal, first of all, was to get the church to wake up and show up in Sacramento and to never go away again, you know, to be basically light and salt there where it's harder. Secondly, that we would establish a blueprint, you know, the academics, the science, that would be available for people who'd want it, the interactive model of how to influence government and so forth, so that like-minded allies in other states with perhaps more receptive legislatures might be able to succeed where we failed. So that was our primary set of goals. Again, we scored big with the one bill, both trying to protect the foster kids. On that one, we lost, but lost to a degree. The bill ended up passing into law, but things have just lit on fire across the country in the past year and a half. And in other countries, too, with, the support's coming from all political sides, from all sides of faith or non-faith, even, you know, a particular help from radical feminists and from some lesbian groups, that everybody agrees you should not be transitioning minors. What an adult does is somewhat on them, but kids need to be protected from this. And that we're seeing a lot of stuff happening worldwide in the industrialized world, which, you know, as you might imagine, U.S., Canada, the English-speaking world tend to be the countries that are very much pushing this. But now we're having assemblages of physicians in national physician groups in Sweden, in the U.K., in Australia, demanding or already having succeeded in getting in motion top-to-bottom reviews of what's called gender affirmation therapy in their countries, because it's just not the standard of care. It's not evidence-based. It's experimental. And clearly, this is something that needs to be reevaluated.
Well, let me ask you, Dr. Van Maal, then, what would you say today is the international standard of care for minors others with gender identity disorders or issues?
Yes. Going back for decades in the literature, the international standard of care is what's called watchful waiting. Now, that does not mean doing nothing, as the sponsoring legislator in California here that I was arguing against said. Watchful waiting incorporates extensive psychological evaluation and support of both the child and the family. And the reason is very straightforward. You are sure to find numerous issues in both that require addressing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that brings up the question, well, what's the usual expected outcome of gender dysphoria in kids? The natural course is for desistance. In the broadest swath of the medical literature, again, going back 40 years, is that it will desist in 60 to 98% of the cases. If we want to weight that a bit, I would say over 85% will desist by adulthood, but not if it's affirmed, let alone if, you know, that young, easily influenced developing mind is hit with puberty blockers and then cross-sex hormones. That's not buying time, as we've been told. It's not a pause button. It's actually selecting persistence over the natural course of desistance. And, you know, again, a kid's not going to know what's going on for years. And you can come to your senses, but what's gone is gone. And we're trying to reduce that kind of calamity from happening.
I just want to ask, does the other side on this issue, those who are really promoting gender-affirming therapy, do they have any significant reliable data whatsoever to support gender affirmation in this? I mean, I've read that, you know, the argument is, well, we can decrease suicide rates by this. And, you know, your argument and the argument of many on the CMDA side is that the data is against gender affirmation.
What they'll generally point to rather quickly are either exceedingly poorly done studies that don't actually quite say what they're claiming, or what professional organizations say. And again, as we should well know by now, professional organizations are not scientific organizations. They're highly easily influenced by ideology. And in terms of, you know, sexual ideology, I'm afraid most of them have been influenced now for decades. In terms of the specific you asked about, suicide reduction is a myth. That is also, by the way, kind of an emotional blackmail and bullying that's done to parents of kids seeking treatment for their child with gender dysphoria. And the usual line they hear is something along the way of, well, do you want a dead son or a live daughter? Well, of course, what's a parent going to say mm-hmm. to that?
Yes.
If I can quote you Bailey and Blanchard, two professors of psychology well-known in the alternative sexuality sphere, and they say there is no persuasive evidence that gender transition reduces gender dysphoric children's likelihood of killing themselves. They also say the idea that mental health problems, including suicidality, are caused by gender dysphoria rather than the other way around is popular, politically correct, and unproven. The study that we like to go to, the best of its kind ever done, a 2011 publication out of Sweden that basically looked at everybody who had sexual reassignment surgery, which I realize now is called gender affirmation surgery, over a 30-year period, all 324 of them, which means selection bias is zero. They controlled for all kinds of factors and looked at all kinds of national registries in Sweden, and they found that 10 years out, those that had had the SRS, which you might call the ultimate form of affirmation, had 19 times the completed suicide rate of the general population, 3 times the all-cause mortality, 5 times the psychiatric hospitalization rate, and so on. That just does not sound like an improvement to me. So these studies that say, oh, the kids are happy, pretty reliably, they're only looking out like 1, 2, maybe 3 years. And again, the kids are still heavily under the influence of whopper doses of opposite sex, which we should call wrong sex hormones. So that the best of the studies out there show that it doesn't reduce suicide.
What other risks do these children or these adolescents have in the case of gender affirmation? What's being proposed and really, really pushed as an ideology that we should facilitate this? Are there other risks?
Yeah. Well, overall, you can look at this as what's the ethical risk of permanently medicalizing somebody that had an 85% chance of desisting by adulthood, and you're doing it purely on a self-diagnosis. I mean, there's no laboratory test, there's no imaging, there's no objective test that I can do or any other professional can do to determine which of these trans-identified kids will persist and which will desist. So it's an extremely iffy thing from the get-go. If it's done early enough, what's being proposed now, the puberty blocking, which if you go with Endocrine Society guidelines means you're administering these puberty blocking agents before Tanner stage two, before puberty's kicked in. Say you do that for the recommended 5 years, there won't be spermatogenesis. You know, the sperm won't develop, the ovaries, the ova won't develop. They won't be there to preserve in the first place. Certainly, if you follow with cross-sex hormones, now you've pretty assuredly got infertility, sterility, quite specifically. And particularly so if you follow that with sex reassignment surgery. There's other, you know, details of what you're basically introducing into a young girl, a premature menopause and the problems that come with that. The stuff that you can find in a broad swath of literature, including from the other side, would be the compromised fertility, sexual dysfunction, dyslipidemias, cholesterol problems, blood clots, what we call thromboembolic disease, cardiovascular and cerebrovascular disease, heart attacks and strokes, osteoporosis. Keep in mind that the puberty years are when the bones undergo their greatest increase in bone mineral density, but not if you block. Consequently, are we looking at people who in their 40s or even their 30s are going to get to experience osteoporosis? And then, of course, the risk of various cancers. We know from the literature, testosterone is going to increase the risk of heart attacks in women fourfold. For guys, for DVTs, strokes, 3 to 5-fold.
Wow.
This is pretty bad news. And it's not like we can tell you what happens decades out. We're just talking about the general risks, you know, of the hormones and stuff involved, which is to say the long-term picture can be considerably worse, particularly if somebody takes their life.
Well, I'm well aware, Andre, that there are certainly economic incentives for physicians and other healthcare professionals to be involved in these gender-affirming clinics where transitioning with hormones or surgery is offered. I was just actually having breakfast with an old friend of mine on Monday. I won't tell you where and who it was, just because of the situation. But he's involved in a specialty that's right on the tip of the spear involved with surgery for transitioning. And he just said to me that the hospital saw this as a real cash cow, that if he didn't get involved, it was going to be really difficult for his department and a university at a hospital if he wasn't involved. And I didn't put him on the spot because he's a believer. But how I wanted to ask, how are you going to get out of this, or are you going to get out of this? So clearly there are financial incentives, and we're aware of some really prominent CMDA members who've been heads of departments who've either stepped down anticipating what's coming or have been forced to step down from departments.
Yes.
So why aren't doctors and therapists speaking out against this if the data seems to be preponderant that this is not the right way to go?
Well, the ideologues are the ones who seem to be controlling the medical organizations and what they write on what the media is doing. And, you know, the ideologues are just running rife all over the countryside with their narrative. A lot of those ideologues are pretty angry and aggressive. So doctors don't speak out because they don't want the hassle. They don't want their name being brought down in the media. I think another reason is doctors don't like to speak out about things they don't know a great deal about. You know,
yes.
We all have a tendency. It's one of the things that hinders evangelism in Christian doctors is, well, we don't know how to evangelize the same way we know how to do medicine, so we'll just wait a while till we know better, right? If you can't do it with medical standards of excellence and perfection, we don't want to approach it. And that's too bad because the people pushing this on the other side know substantially less than we do. And the other risk would be quite simply, you know, so many of us work for larger organizations, and there is the direct threat to your employment, which, of course, people can lose their jobs very quickly on this. And sometimes it's not even that you weren't affirming, it's that you were insufficiently celebratory, right? You say the wrong thing at the wrong time, so it is. But you're quite right about the money trail. You know, if we talk about what should be the prevalence of gender dysphoria, gender identity issues, according to the DSM-5, it's thousands of a percent. You know, for females, it's 0.002 to 0.003%, slightly more for men, but not much more. But now we have surveys telling us 2% of America's youth say, yeah, I could be trans. Well, that's a radical opening up of your market share. Some of this is being strongly supported and financed by the pharmaceutical firms, by tech firms, because once someone begins any degree of so-called transition, you're going to be a medical patient for the rest of your life. You'll need the hormones and medications and treatment for the complications thereof. Whatever degree of surgery you have has its own shortcomings, risks, and complications, and then further need for surgery. You will be a cash cow as long as you live, which will be a shortened life expectancy. So looking at it that way, it's profoundly sleazy. I would add, as I have in print and in speaking engagements a few times, and others have too, this mirrors the lobotomy craze of the 50s and 60s. Yeah. You had the professionals pushing that, professional organizations saying as much. And my understanding from my reading is the Portuguese neurologist who developed the lobotomy procedure ended up winning the Nobel Prize, I believe, in the late 40s for it. And now, of course, we look back on it as a catastrophe, a tragedy, and we're repeating it now, but we're doing it with kids.
Well, I don't know, Andre, how you found the time to write so many different articles, journal articles, as well as blog posts. You've written prolifically on our CMDA Point blog, and I've got a long list here of some of the blogs that you've written, including on this topic, one of which you wrote this summer, scapegoating the church for LGBT suicide and stigma. So is Orthodox Christian teaching, is it proving harmful to these sexual minorities?
We can point you to literature that says the opposite. I tried to give this in writing to our state legislature this year because of a non-binding resolution they were passing that pretty much included what you've just said. 2019, just this year, a paper called Same-Sex Attracted, Not LGBTQ. And what's interesting about it is this was a conjoined team of progressive psychologists and therapists, by which I mean, acronym affirming, and conservative ones, by which I mean change allowing. And they were looking at the specifics of sexual minorities in the Mormon church. And interestingly, they found that people who came out as gay and rejected Mormonism and went secular, comparing them to those who held on strongly to their Mormon faith, rejected identifying as same-sex attracted and, trying to live life, we'll say, more the way God intended, but say, stay married to your opposite sex spouse and so forth, that they experienced equal benefits regarding depression, anxiety, general life satisfaction, and flourishing. Now, a critic would look at that and say, well, if it's the same to be secular as religious, forget you and to be secular. That's not it. This directly contradicts minority stress theory expectations. Mm-hmm. I mean, if the argument is, hey, you get religion, you're going to die, this directly contradicts that. A 2017 study, conveniently titled Happily Religious, a few more words in there, but that's the main thing, showed no significant differences found between mainline Protestants, and they specify those who often accept same-sex relationships, and evangelical Protestants who obviously don't. Again, directly contradicts minority stress theory. Interestingly, in this study, those who fared the worst were those of alternative sexuality who were atheist, agnostic, or had no religious affiliation. And a 2013 study looking specifically at Black GLB-identified youths found that those who had the higher religious faith scores also had the highest resiliency scores. Mind you, that's resiliency, not suicidality. A study I just became aware of a few months ago. Actually, a national survey, 2017, the National School Climate Survey, put out by GLSEN, the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Educational Network. And, they're the ones that want to have an enormous swath of gender-affirming everything in every school in America if they could have it. And they found, maybe to their horror, that religious schools, meaning ones that didn't have any of that acronym-affirming curriculum, teachers, materials, so forth, they found those the safest places for sexual minority students. They had the fewest episodes of bullying, victimization, and they fared even better than the private secular schools that had the whole shooting match of GLBT-affirming curricula. So we are not the problem. We are a help. I would add that, some of the studies that show some of these bad results, particularly if we're talking about change-allowing therapy, tend to look only at those who would then identify as secular and gay or so forth. They directly exclude those that benefited, those that don't identify as gay despite same-sex attraction. They don't buy the ideology, even in the presence of personal struggles they have. And of course, you know, ultimately, none of this stuff is new. I mean, we're told in Ecclesiastes there's nothing new under the sun.
Right.
It wasn't new to Jesus. It wasn't new to Paul. And we're not smarter than those guys were. And you know, Jesus Christ changes lives. I know to some people that sounds really trite, but ultimately what we're talking about is lives, both in this world, you know, and the life to come.
Dr. Van Mol, I think you're in the crucible there in California. So how are you handling this with the legal climate that you face in California? You're a busy family physician. How are you handling it when parents bring in their adolescents or younger children who are struggling with these issues? Are you practicing according to your deeply held religious beliefs, or are you having to make some compromises that you still feel okay with?
I've pretty much tried to be faithful to what I believe is not just my beliefs, but what I think is objective reality and truth. And I think that better serves the patient. So that involves, well, you know, last time it came up, it was a person who was, you know, 19, could make their own decisions. I just calmly explained, you know, I've been your doctor and you've been my patient for some time. We trust each other. There's a relationship here. And I want this relationship to continue, even if we disagree on some strongly held things. I will respect you no matter what. My job is to lay out the best of the information for you to make your decision. When the subject's minors, you're, of course, more talking to the parents. And so far, the ones I've run into have been very relieved to hear there's a lot of support to the idea of, you know, let's look and see what's underneath this, which is, of course, the grand truth here, is there are always underlying factors.
Yes.
You know, be they psychological, be they family dynamic, be they, you know, naturally, usually a combination of the above, adverse childhood experiences. And, of course, one of the subpopulations we're seeing extremely disproportionately affected are those with neurodevelopmental problems, by which I mean autism spectrum. Those kids tend to think very concretely. They latch on to ideas. And with the internet and the media trying so hard to evangelize them in the direction of trans ideology, they lock onto the idea of, oh, now I know why I'm different than all my friends. It's because I'm trans. And once that idea gets there, of course, they tend to lock onto it with often poor consequences. So we live in a time, Mike, where good science, good theology, and good ethics are the same. You just have to be educated in them.
Well, speaking of education, I know that your most recent blog article that you wrote for The Point was specifically about a resource for parents. Tell us about this resource that I believe you were recruited to help with just because of your experience in California last year.
Yeah, it's called The Parents Resource Guide, and the e-version of it is available for free download at genderresourceguide.com. Every parent out there who has kids in school really ought to have it, and it's written in such a way, so nicely organized, so clear, and with so much citation evidence, I think it benefits care providers as well to have it on hand. And again, it's a freebie. It reads fairly quickly. You know, if I tell you it's 50 or 60 pages, you'll panic. It doesn't really read like that. The pages are better organized and made to be easily gone through, but that one's a complete winner.
And it's very helpful for parents to be advocates in their communities and the schools to help with the challenges that are just coming. They are coming for public schools, any other schools for that matter.
Yeah, very much. And, you know, there's guidelines there on how to interact with the school, how to be civil, sample letters that might be needed for different eventualities. It's really quite a nice little all-in-one thing. And again, it's a freebie.
Well, for our members, as we close, our ethics committee and our board worked very hard on the whole issue of transgenderism. And we have a position statement that I think is very consistent with much of what Dr. Van Mol has shared today. So if you just go to cmda.org/transgender identity, you will see our position statement, which is 2 or 3 pages. A very helpful resource, I think, also with biblical support for the position that we have taken at CMDA. Andre, thank you so much in the middle of your busy workday there in California for joining us and for sharing with us. And I wish that we could get 100 more Dr. Andre Van Mals across this country being salt and light and speaking out for truth out of compassion with gentleness and respect. Thank you for serving so faithfully and boldly on the West Coast.
Thank you much, Mike.
Well, I'm sure that Andre would agree with me that as expressive as he is and powerful his communication and all the things that he's been involved with in public policy, he didn't start that way. He went through our Voice of Christian Doctors training a few years ago, and that training we do once or twice a year, and it's coming up May 15th and 16th here in Bristol. If you'd like to go to cmda.org/events, you'll find out information about how you can get involved. There are some slots still available for this May's training to help inform you and equip you to speak up. And I mentioned in my interview with Andre that a lot of what's driving or seems to be driving this whole transgender transitioning, gender-affirming surgery train is finances. And I was really blown away when my own professional journal, the Journal of the American College of Surgeons, one of the lead articles on the front cover is entitled "The Financial Impact of Gender Confirmation Surgery." And the thrust of the article, without talking about complications or morbidity and mortality whatsoever, the article is about the fact that this kind of surgery is a money maker for a healthcare institution. If you think this is not going to impact your practice, if you think that as a healthcare professional who's not a pediatrician or a pediatric endocrinologist or a plastic surgeon or urologist, think again. I think this is going to have impact on so many different medical specialties, and so we need to speak up. The other opportunity that you could have to listen and hear Andre Van Mall speak in person is a conference on February 29th, Leap Day. At CMDA, we are collaborating with the Dallas Theological Seminary and the Christian Legal Society for a one-day summit on right of conscience and cultural change in medicine. There'll be numerous topics. Andre will be talking about this issue of transgender and human sexuality and our right of conscience. So if you can fit that into your schedule, I'd encourage you to sign up today for that February 29th conference. A couple of books that I'd like to recommend to you as a follow-up to today's interview with Dr. Van Mall. Dr. Nancy Piercy's book entitled "Love Thy Body, Answering Hard Questions About Life and Sexuality." Nancy was one of our speakers at our national convention last year. That book is very powerful and will help equip you to deal with the challenges in your healthcare practice or in your family, in your community, and church. Also, a book, "When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment," by Ryan Anderson from the Heritage Foundation. You can go online, cmda.org/resources, or call 888-230-2637 and talk to one of our staff, and they'll make sure they get one or both of these books in the mail to you right away. Well, as I close this program, I'm sure that I don't have to remind you that we are in the midst of a battle. It's a spiritual battle, and as Paul reminded us, that we're not wrestling against flesh and blood, but against spiritual forces in the heavenly realms. Paul also told us in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 2 to 5, "I beg you that when I come, I may not have to be as bold as I expect to be towards some who say that we live by the standards of this world. For though we live in this world, we don't wage war as the world does. The weapons that we fight with are not the weapons of this world. Instead, they have divine power to demolish strongholds. We demolish arguments and every pretense that sets itself up against the knowledge of God, and we take captive every thought to make it obedient unto Christ." Our opposition, ideagogues, they have set up their synagogues in our medical schools and other institutions of higher healthcare education. They're all around us. I'm going to challenge you to be strong and courageous. That is the theme of our national convention in the middle of April in Cincinnati. If you would like to find out more about our national convention with this theme and emphasis, we'll be challenged by Reverend Bruce Boria from New Hampshire, one of the largest churches in New Hampshire, will be talking to us on that theme of be strong and courageous at this time. Well, until next week, I want to remind you that CMDA matters because you matter. As a Christian in healthcare who has the opportunity to represent the hands and feet of Christ to provide hope and healing for the world. God bless you.
This podcast has been a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on this podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.